the essential podcast for educators in the UK, made by teachers for teachers.
Hello and welcome to Homework Podcast. This morning we are going to be talking about teaching 2 years on. So you've done your teacher training, you've completed your portfolio, your folder, the infamous tome of preparation, planning and reflections that you're kind of obliged to create and carry around with you. But then what happens 2 years later, gentlemen? What do you keep in practice? What do you think? Do you adapt? What is it, that thing that you learn to, you qualify and then you really learn to teach? What do we think?
I think just some of the things you just mentioned about the fact that there's just like a wealth of paperwork and folders and portfolios that you produce, I can hand on heart say I've not opened them since. So that sort of process of all that accumulation of evidence and, and things at the time, certainly on the course that David and I did, so the SKIT course, that was the be all and end all. That was huge. And I think producing that took so much time. In actual fact, now we look back probably in the last couple of years, that sort of side of it is just gone for us. I think it's all about learning on the job. I think the things you pick up in training are useful, but nothing can replicate being in the classroom with the children, particularly that second year when you're not an AGT anymore, when that support drops off and it is your domain, they're your children. It is a bit sink or swim, like, but you have to think on your feet and adapt, and I think that's the best way to learn. I think the SKIT program for us is probably a happy middle ground because there is a lot of classroom practice.
Sure.
And obviously, you may have done a different route then, but for us, we had a degree already, and it was a one-year placement, essentially, in the school right now. And you do have to spend a lot of time in the classroom, and David and I are in a unique position where we actually took over classes before we qualified, which massively throw us in the deep end. But I would say, and speaking for David, you can disagree if you don't feel this way, but I think that was the best part of the process.
No, that was really cool. I think the other thing that comes up an awful lot in teacher training, and maybe it's myself as an individual, just not the way I perhaps learn, but there's an awful lot of sort of theory of learning, like how children learn, the sort of cognitive processes, breaking down what effective learning looks like. Now, that's something that a couple of years on, I find I'm almost like delving back into that a little bit, and now it seems a little bit more interesting and relevant to me. But I think at the time, what I found productive was seeing teachers teach, interacting with children, teaching lessons and reflecting on why they weren't great. Whereas sometimes I found on my teacher training, I was asked to conduct some quite heavy reading into like theory-based sort of research. And for me, there was an awful lot of that in teacher training, which I felt at the time was not really giving me much, and I was trying to balance that with an awful lot of like admin and paperwork. So I think a couple of years on, yes, we still have a lot of administrative tasks to do as teachers, but on the whole, you can see a purpose to those, where a lot of the time in teacher training, there is that sort of evidence for evidence sake in some respects.
Yeah.
I think as well that administrative sort of side of it, when you're training, certainly for us was all about ourselves, wasn't it? It was reflecting on our best practice. It was looking at every lesson in detail and all that theory-based evidence and assignments. Whereas now I think the paperwork, and there are times obviously as teachers where we are swamped with paperwork, but I think you're right, there's value in it because it does have impact on the children, and we can look at progress. There's a lot more sort of child-centered paperwork than there was for us, I think, as individuals training.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult balance, isn't it? Because I think that you have to, like, I did the PGCE, and now I mentor students doing a B.Ed. And I must admit, I kind of feel that talking to a lot of people doing the B.Ed, and I've got a lot of friends who did that it takes such a huge amount of time. Now, if, as in the 3 or 4 year course. Now,
was your route yourself from?
So I did the journalism degree.
Okay,
and then a one year PGCE. And that's almost my point. So if all three of us came to this job with a degree, with a different undergrad degree, and it was and with things that were not related to teaching in really in any way, shape, or form, and we were then able to convert that in a year into being able to teach, I struggle to see kind of the relevance of perhaps a four year because I kind of feel like if I was able to study the art of journalism and media for 3 years, fine, but that was nothing to, other than by, I guess,
there's
a higher
some
standard
basic
of English.
Overlap skills,
yeah, there is some basic overlap skills
and stuff,
but as you say, like the amount of theory and the amount of time that undergrad B.Ed students spend going through endless Vygotsky and all this stuff, and I just think that, in actual fact, as we've just touched on, what how is that directly going? Like, and I understand that this is kind of the way that the unis do it, but honestly, if I didn't need that to the same degree, and you didn't need that, and you didn't need that, the myriad of teachers out there who didn't do that route have been fantastic teachers. why do they need it? Like, what is genuinely, if we think about, you just said it about impact on children.
Yeah.
This, the kind of pyramid of needs, to be fair, without kind of being patronising, you don't need to be a teacher to know that, and you don't need to look at a nice little colourful triangle to know that if a child hasn't been fed, that they're not going to be in a great position to learn. And I kind of, that's perhaps my thing, is that in actual fact, have we got this backwards? Are we spending so much time looking at the theory? Mm-hmm. And for my first year students, currently, they joined us in the February. So they started their course in September. They haven't come into a classroom until February. Smart. Despite the fact that that's the main part, that's the most important thing, and some of these young people and second career people haven't actually been in a classroom properly.
And look at the things which impact teacher dropout rate in the first 5 years. Generally, the big factors are work-life balance and behaviour management issues in the classroom. Like, you can sit and read a textbook about how to manage behaviour all day long, but actually being in different classrooms, seeing different teachers manage different children, that is where you pick things up. That's where you learn to adapt and reflect. And I do kind of think, like, I haven't done that 3 or 4 year uni route for teaching, so I don't know, I'm speculating to an extent, but some of the stuff does seem totally irrelevant, often time fillers. And there's other things you get, like a lot of PGCE students, subject specialised, so they'll do some, you know, modules or special area focuses in a particular subject, which I think in theory sounds excellent. But if you then choose to subject specialise and end up at a school where you're leading a different subject or where your school follows a scheme of learning where it isn't relevant, I do wonder how many PE subject specialists, you know, English subject specialists, are actually using the bulk of what they've spent that time doing at university, and whether or not that time could be better spent, on the sort of shop floor, interacting with children and seeing teaching firsthand.
I think you're right. I think for us, obviously, we're all pretty active on Twitter. I think when you see a lot of training teachers now, in their sort of bios, it says what they're specialising in. So that clearly is happening. And I think if we're saying that the 3 or 4 year course possibly is just very dragged out, are the universities, are the providers just padding it in with this sort of specialism element?
And
trying to get more out of it in terms years in the course. I think, for me, just listening to both of you, as individuals who want to be teachers, in the process of training to be a teacher, I don't think any of us are sort of thrown in on day one thinking, oh, what am I doing here? Like, we're there because we have the initiative, we have the passion, the drive. And I think personally that outweighs the theory, the reading, that, because we can pick up if a child is struggling with something.
And I don't think
you need to read a book to tell you that.
And I'll be honest, to a degree, I disagree with you actually, David, where you're saying, like, I don't feel like I'm needing to, as arrogant as that sounds, I don't feel like I'm needing to delve back into research.
I
don't, because the fact is, if I have a child that has attachment disorder, or I'm worried about their kind of attachment, I go and speak to my Senko. He might then recommend that I look at this report, or I take a look at that.
Yeah.
But I don't, or if I've got a child who's suffering neglect, I go and talk to my child protection team, or I go and talk to my year group lead, or I'm not for a minute suggesting that we do not need to have an understanding of theory, but I am saying that I don't actually feel that often I've ever, in the nearly 10 years I've been teaching, encountered a problem and thought, oh, I'll go and buy a book.
No, it's not so much that. I'm kind of, what I've got in mind is, Sam and I went to Primary Rocks a few weeks back and we sat in a Claire Seeley workshop, and she was talking about, like, learning schemas, and it was all very sort of, like, very theoretical, and I kind of thought, like, this is the sort of thing a couple of years ago I could not relate to at all, and there was still plenty that I was stretching to understand.
Some of it,
I could at least link this to children and experiences.
So I see what you're saying in terms of that, in terms of that sometimes you perhaps need to have experienced these situations to understand what people are talking about.
But I certainly don't rush to textbooks.
If we are genuinely saying, and I've got a lot of friends external to kind of Twitter that are teachers, if we are saying that realistically the actual theory and some of these fantastic books that these brilliant educationalists write, and I'm not for a minute criticising their aims or their value in that regard, but are practicing frontline general teachers reading these books and implementing what is said in these books. And I'm talking like deep analysis of research across thousands of children. I mean, personally, I read books that relate mainly to my role as a reading lead.
Sure.
And that, and about how to teach reading in school. I don't see that theoretical kind of
CPD, isn't it?
Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah. And when we're, and a lot of teachers,
you sort of dip in and out of those things.
Well, and also the amount, with the amount of time it takes, I prioritise reading children's books because I need to know my children's literature.
I think so.
And I think that it's a difficult one. If we're sitting here now and saying, I don't believe that anyone can walk around a school and say, you were a B-Ed, you were a PCE, you were a SKIT. I just don't believe it.
No.
And therefore, if you're able to achieve the same in a small amount of time, why have we not? Why are the teachers' unions?
Well,
why are the Chartered College, etc., not challenging these universities and saying, I'm not for a minute suggesting that we should dilute the kind of quality of the delivery, but is it the same? Is there an educational system where we're doing the same that we've done for 100 years and we haven't actually looked at it and thought, can we do this better?
Controversially, I would argue that potentially you could go around a room and notice that early in the NQT year. I think you look at people who have spent more time in the classroom, you know, during their training year, perhaps they are more classroom ready, school ready than the people who are spending 4 weeks, 6 weeks at a time.
I think if you, and obviously Ben, you did the EBED.
No, I did the PCE.
Sorry, PCE, but you did the skip program. I think if you came into our school, if you saw David and I, first year, second year in teaching, and you saw other teachers in our school.
But that could just be particular to you guys
rather
than the course.
Absolutely, like institutionalised in the old way, absolutely. But I think David, there's a middle ground. I think honestly you could. Like, and I think David, myself, like some of our friends who have done the skit.
I've known people who have come into their NQT from a 4-year uni degree and it's been like, they've verbalised it they just haven't, like a good friend of mine spent, like his first time on his own as a teacher in a classroom was his induction day with his class.
Argue that is down to that particular case, because I've got lots of friends that did a B.Ed that you wouldn't, but that isn't the case.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I think if you were to genuinely send in an Ofsted inspector or whatever, I don't believe I'm not for a minute, and I don't think it's healthy for us to try and kind of rank which courses we think are the best or which paths are the best way. But I do think that we as a culture need to actually look at how all of these courses are operating, because if you can do it effectively by doing a skit, then why are we making some people stay in uni for 4 years?
Yeah.
And if we actually ask teachers what they think, like, also not to mention the fact that I train at Winchester, the fact that half the cohort were told, oh, you're good enough to do it in 3 years, and half of them were told, no, you need to do it in 4. Well, what were the ones doing it in 4 not doing it the ones in 3 were doing? And if that is the case, why was that not being picked up on? Because we as professionals wouldn't be allowed to say to our classes, you've got to stay back a year and no repercussions. Or does it come down to money? Is it as cynical as that?
I hadn't appreciated that was how it worked. When people say, I did 3 or I did 4 years.
That's to my understanding. I'm sure Twitter will correct me if I'm wrong, but that is my understanding. Whether it's that they had to opt to do an extra module, I don't know. But touching back on what you were saying there, another thing that I completely agree with you, just completely goes out the window, is subject specialism. And I do feel for students that perhaps you talk to that, I would say there are a few things. I would say computing, if you have a subject specialism in computing, I think just the extra work that you have to do for that does put you in a very good position.
And that's an asset to a school.
Yeah, but other than computing, I would honestly challenge how much of those specialisms are then used. I mean, technically, mine was an English specialism because I did a journalism degree. And fine, English is kind of what I help to lead now. But that isn't because that was my subject specialism. That's just because that was the direction that I pushed in and where the school needed me. Like, if you do a specialism, how many people do a PE specialism? And it's one of the biggest subjects nowadays in modern education that a specialist, a coach comes in and delivers. Yeah. So yeah, what is the point in specialism? I don't understand it.
I guess it's the only subject that's oversubscribed as well. Like, we have too many PE teachers.
So why do we have subject specialisms during training?
I guess looking at the sort of Ofsted's proposed framework for revamping and looking at the wider curriculum, it's a bit of a mouthful. I guess there will be perhaps a heavier emphasis on subjects like the humanities. And I certainly have been at a school where there's been different people in the last few years leading those subjects, and they aren't necessarily always people who have a wealth of knowledge in those subjects. I could quite easily end up leading geography next year, and I don't have much beyond my pre-GCSE knowledge of geography. So whilst I think there are subjects where it perhaps applies less, I do think some subject specialisms in schools, science is another one,
that only works if the person with the subject specialism is given that subject to lead.
Yeah. Well, 100%.
Like, otherwise,
with
just,
freedom to like, sort of implant.
But also, we go back to it again. I did my degree 10 years ago. My my training in having an English subject specialism is 10 years out of date. Mm. So what relevance does that have anymore? Right. What about the teachers that qualified so long ago,
had a different
curriculum and didn't even have subject specialisms? Like,
the other one that I think we must touch on in this podcast when it comes to sort of trainee teachers looking a few years on is the whole process of observations. I think when you're a trainee, like as a teacher now, we're judged on expected to know our class inside out, know the needs of each learner, know what helps them, know what their individual targets and goals are. When you're a trainee teacher, you're being observed, but generally observed in isolated one-off lessons with a class that aren't your class, that you don't really know inside out in quite the same way you could ever know as a teacher. And I think that process is very tricky and then leads to judgments. Like, I don't know, the course Sam and I did, we had a good and outstanding and a pass, and we both got outstanding, but what does that even mean? Like, they've watched a handful of us, you know, external observer has seen us three times in a year, and they've decided that that and a folder of information makes us better than others, and I just don't understand it.
These teachers now, like, there are ideas that you can roll out a sort of bells and whistles lesson, and it could be outstanding in the judgment of the person looking at you. But, like, needless to say, like, there will be people who do get outstanding in three lessons across the year, but do generally find it incredibly tough. Yeah.
This idea of outstanding,
I hate
especially as a student, fact, but especially as a student, does make me laugh a little, because you think, how can they can't be outstanding? Like, if we're talking, as far as I'm concerned, they are assessed on the same criteria that we are assessed, the teacher standards. Yes?
What they'd say is it's a sort of teacher standard light.
But you still cannot say to me, I have yet to see any student anywhere deliver a lesson that is of such supreme quality, especially their first, like, and I speak for myself in that regard. Like, my student lessons were terrible compared to what I deliver now. Now, fine, if you can say at this point in your development, but that isn't codified or written anywhere.
No.
And as you've just said, 90% of it just simply comes down to one person's opinion.
Yeah.
One person's opinion who might not have taught for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. No, I think it's like a marketing thing for course providers to say we've had X percent of outstanding trainees. I think it's,
and the school,
again, that judgment is a little bit damaging, isn't it? When and it applies to schools, you know, as well.
It's funny, my current boss said that hates the kind of banners outside of school, and he said, because what do you do, and I see his point, he's like, what do you do if you were outstanding and then your next Ofsted you get good?
No, it's tricky.
Do you go outside and cut the banner down, or do you have to, like, cover it up, or, like, do you sort of secretly burn it
in the night?
And how does that reflect on the local community when suddenly that lovely plastic banner draped across your fencing is removed? And that's not to criticise schools that want to do that, because I can understand that, especially in perhaps tough areas and tough communities, people want to be proud of that, and I get that, I really do, but what does it even mean?
No, and it's the same, we know that there's a vastly distorted percentage of outstanding schools in more affluent areas. Now, when it comes to rating trainees, let's not overlook that the school that you're in is going to have quite a big impact on the development process you
100%.
Have. And you don't always get a job in that school. And even if you do, you're not always going to be there forever. So what is the point in pumping up egos, telling people they're outstanding where their peers down the road might be good? What's the point?
But they're having to deal with much more severe behaviour issues. And I think, look, and this is, I think we would all agree, none of this is attempting to knock or discredit or slate the fantastic students and the hard work that people put in. Because it's not, because it is, I think year on year it gets harder. Like, the people that I have mentored and stuff, the amount of work they have to do, the amount of reflections that they have to do, and planning on there on multiple different formats, and uploading it all onto an online form. Now they have to have an online folder and a real folder. And I just, like, I just look at a lot of these 18-year-old kids, and I think, like, what a way to welcome them into what is, in my opinion, the best profession that you can have, is to absolutely almost pummel them.
It's a flog, isn't it? And, like, we've got a chap who, a mate of ours, who's teacher training at our school next year, and there has been, we've had chats with him, and we've been like, oh, yeah, it's going to be a really tough year, it'll be great, but then it will get easier. And we'd have both been told that when we were training. And it's always just like, you're right, it's this idea that you're just going to spend a year of absolutely flogging yourself, working endless hours, getting minimal sleep. What is the point? And why drag that out for 3 years, 4 years? Like, what is the point? I simply don't get it. We've got a shortage of teachers. We need people in the profession. Why can't we get them in the profession, see if they like it, see if they're any good, help support and develop them on the job?
That's the other thing that really, really does wind me up. And I know that different initial teacher training providers do it differently. But why on earth are we holding these people back until the February before? No, but why are we holding them back to even enter a classroom in some cases until a February when they may turn around and go, don't actually like it. So they'll have spent 6 months of their life, dozens and dozens, hundreds of hours of prep time, and they could genuinely walk in and go, do you know what? Like, I love kids, but I'm just not cut out for this.
I mean, that 6 months is not 6 months that we as a country, when we need teachers, can be wasting.
I'm not saying let's like just whiz them through willy nilly, but I do think it comes back to what we talked about with timetables and curriculum, that we haven't. No one has sat down and said, is this the best way that we can be doing this?
I mean, to my knowledge, there's going to be a change to the NQT setup, isn't there? There's going to be a 2-year NQT process going forward, like adding more release time for NQT plus ones or RQTs.
And how do we pay for that?
How's that going to be paid for? Could there be a way where there's a little bit more training on the job over an extended period of time? So maybe not the 1 year skit year, maybe some sort of like 2 year on the job developmental process. I don't know. Maybe there's a way of like combining the two agreements where there's some more time in schools, but then those people are spending more than that 1 day a week at university. Maybe it's a 2-3 day split. I don't know, but I just think, as you say, there's people that are sitting in lecture theatres and classrooms who could be helping children all the time. They could be, you know, we've got a massive shortage of support staff in schools. There's a massive shortage of bodies in schools. I have
two students at the moment, and they're great, and like they've been in since February for 2 days a week, and after the Easter they're in 5 days a week for the first half term, and I'm suddenly in a position that, say, on a Monday I've got five adults in that room. Like, that's 1 to 6. Like, I've got I can actually, I'm in a position where I can break down the learning for these kids and really give them the support they need. That is fantastic. Now, I'm not saying that is practical in every classroom. I'm not saying that in some cases it's probably too many adults because you end up falling over each other. But I am saying that I see the work they have to put in and the expectations that they're having to do. And to be fair, I think we'll all hold our hands up. This is probably a podcast that we could have done with having someone that had done the B.Ed on. So please do let us know what you think.
Maybe a follow-up.
But something needs to change. Something. If we can all qualify, and all of us are perfectly successful teachers, if we can all do it with 1 year of teacher training, why are we making people do 4 years?
I don't understand.
It's almost implying that because you've done that sort of degree already, it's almost age. It's almost like you've got the life skills.
I'm not buying this idea that it's study skills. I learn how to use a camera and how to present a news bulletin.
And now you do a podcast.
Yeah.
There are also study skills you don't really use when you're a teacher, are they? Don't sit and write essays, and you don't sit, you know, like you might choose to, but they're not skills that then transfer into the workplace at all. They also contradict everything that we're told makes a good learner and makes an effective lesson. Like, we're told to, you know, that activity, kinesthetic learning, learn from first-hand experiences, and then you're sitting in a lecture theatre being spoken to
for hours and hours
with a load of printed out PowerPoint slides that you're doodling on. It's just pointless.
I think we touched on pretty much throughout this, that obviously we believe that all this theory-based learning has a place, but I think in-class practice and experience is beneficial. And I think if we're saying like your trainees now, they're coming in more heavily after the Easter break, which is fantastic, but those 6 months where they've been in lecture halls and in classrooms, with them being the learners, like, get them in the schools from day one. I think, firstly, it would just help as a school, because like you're saying, you can really then help to progress the children on because they've got so much more support. And I think, touching on what you said, David, about the NQT sort of programme, I think one thing I've noticed is that obviously there are different NQT programmes, and therefore the level of support in different schools and different areas is different, and therefore you're going to get teachers with different levels of sort of confidence. Because I know, my NQT programme wasn't particularly... I don't know, I just didn't think it really helped me at all.
Do you know the ironic thing, and this is more common than you think, my NQT mentor wasn't even in my school.
Really?
That makes no sense.
So how on earth... And so I was in a 3-4 entry school.
This is an academy.
This was before academies, okay. Mate. I was in a 3-4 entry school, and my head of year, awful for her. Her mum passed away within a month of me being there, so she left. I was working with my other year group partner, who had been teaching 2 years, and our year group was plummeting. We were in special measures already at this school, and my mentor was at a school half a mile down the road. Now that cannot be unique. And that cannot be...
It's not that sort of hands-on support.
No, and you can't tell me that that was rare either. Because you think logically about the number of schools, that it must occur. And that kind of typifies it to me. I've seen it done brilliantly. Where I am now, the support for NQTs is fantastic. They have weekly meetings and everything. Like it looks great from the outside. Yeah. But my NQT time, I'll be honest... I was given every Wednesday off. I went and sat in the computing room on my own for the whole day. I could have been doing anything.
Yeah.
It's just dead time. Marking, isn't it? Really.
Marking. Just
catching up.
Which
on marking,
isn't the purpose.
No, it's not the purpose at all.
But I know for us...
It is nice to be able to, like, the only thing that I'd say you get more of in NQT time is just being able to go and observe other teachers. Like, cause that is hard
That's
to
true.
Do when you
Absolutely.
Don't get the time.
Absolutely. But also, like, if you're in a school where that kind of natural CPD is done regularly anyway, you might already have seen everybody in your school within a month, and you might not be in a school where your head teacher's happy for you to go and visit other places.
Schools obviously have to provide NQT support, but like, I know for a fact that our school sort of opt into additional things, which is great, but there should surely be a standard, because if you, like yourself, this experience you had where there was a mentor from another school, and if you compare that to us, you had a mentor in our school, like, it's not a level playing field.
It's not.
No wonder that you're saying that your group is plummeting, because foundations of great teaching is support and is learning from others. And I think if you don't have that, no wonder you found it tricky. I think there's got to be a standardised sort of method of support, because there's people that are struggling. Like, we've got, and they're not really seeing NQTs, we've got colleagues who've come across from Canada, and in terms of experience, they're an NQT, as in this is their first year out of training, but because they've not done the sort of PGCE or the B-Ed or the SKIT in this country, they don't fall under that category, criteria.
Yeah.
So therefore, they aren't getting their support. And it's like, how are we ever going to improve our education system and have the best teachers possible without the same support for everyone?
No, 100%. Just for my own amusement and perhaps people listening, I wondered if we might be able to see what we could cough up about Vygotsky. It's obviously been a few years since we've sat and learnt about this chap with our learning theory. So I just wondered if any of us had to retain
my evidence folder.
So Sam, is there anything you can...
Vygotsky, social learning theory.
What does that mean?
Is that Piaget's social learning theory? I was in a group called Piaget, I think.
Was it Ars Vygotsky? But from the off the top of my head, I honestly, like, the names ring a bell, but I can't think that it is
it's scaffolding, isn't it, Vygotsky?
Yeah,
so it's the idea of enabling all children to achieve. But
which we probably do anyway without...
But, and that's the point, and I guess, and we do need to kind of wind this one up.
It is funny, though, that we're like...
We do need to kind of wind this one up, but that is the point. And I think if you're a head teacher listening, start of your staff meeting after the Easter break, you genuinely ask your staff to write down their top three social theorists or educational theorists and their key points. Because it's that thing that every teacher, or the vast majority of teachers in this country, are doing it. but they don't know that that's what it's called. So it doesn't matter.
Do you need to know?
Yet we all have books.
Oh, it's trendy. Hundreds of pounds.
It's trendy.
Of those
in my classroom, I've got a lovely little sort of set of books that I have to say have not been opened since the day that I've got these books.
Get them on eBay.
Yeah, you've just got. I just think read the ones that you think will change your practice, and the rest of them skip them.
Yeah.
And I mean, not jump over them. I mean, put them in a skip. Fair play to Vygotsky at a time that perhaps that wasn't considered. But nowadays, we care.
Yeah.
And there's so many other things.
It's just whether it's worth the time of trainee teachers.
When are we supposed to... But not just trainees, mate. Well, everyone else.
Yeah.
When are teachers supposed to do this? We're constantly bombarded with, oh, well, we need more time for this. And, I try and really push teachers to read children's books. And the big thing that I get back is, when am I supposed to do that? And I get that.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
So if
you've got to really make time for it. Yeah, it's hard.
But how do you do that? How can you?
If you've got kids at home, if you want
a social life, like we already work some of the longest hours in the world.
No, it's tough.
Like I think that
it's a hard balance to find.
Yeah. And I really sympathise with senior leaderships that people say, oh, well, you need to be given release time. Well, how? How am I supposed to be given release time to go
and
read the book? I can't justify that.
And also, that's the detriment of the children.
Of course it is.
Class teachers out all the time.
Is reading that book going to make a net profit against the loss?
I would love release time to sit and read some children's lit. Could you imagine?
I'd like a rocking chair.
In the library.
Beanbags.
Pair of sandals.
He'd be loving it.
Maybe. Diet 7-Up.
This should be good. We'll have a word.
Homework. Made for teachers, by teachers.
Right, well, we would love to hear your thoughts, as always, especially, as we said, from sort of those of you that have done BEDs or even perhaps initial teacher training providers. We'd love to hear what you have to say, what you think about kind of everything that we've discussed today. And as always, thanks for listening.
Happy reading.
Take care, guys. Thank you.
For much more content exclusively for teachers by teachers, visit homeworkmagazine.co.uk. Also, please follow us on social media at homework_magazine and at homework_podcast. Homework Podcast is brought to you by Iguanas Producciones.